From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the final part of our series on the four very different plans to remodel derelict blocks of downtown Sacramento's K Street. Also, bluegrass singer Susie Glaze and a new website that's all about Sacramento's long history with baseball. First, a garden at UC Davis that you can eat. It's called the Good Life Garden, and it's not far from the Mondavi Center. Specifically, it's in the courtyard at the Mondavi Institute for Wine and Food Science, which is just next door to the Mondavi Center. The landscape architect who designed it and the gardener there both join us. We'll start with Christina Reyes, landscape architect at UC Davis, designer of the garden. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
What were you asked to create when someone said, Christina, we'd like a Good Life Garden?
My boss at the grounds division at UC Davis asked me to create an edible garden with vegetables and annual flowers that was beautiful. I think he used the word stunning, and it needed to look good all the time. And so that was quite a challenge.
Yeah, that's quite a lineup of things you had to deliver.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was a very exciting challenge, and I worked very hard over the course of months to put together an initial plan for the first planting, which was in the fall of 2008. And we worked very carefully with Seeds of Change, as a seed company out of New Mexico, organic seed company. And they helped quite a bit with the selection of varieties.
Yes.
And then assisted me also with understanding how vegetables grow. I'm not a gardener myself. I'm a landscape architect and a designer, but not a gardener. So,
well, that's what I was just about to ask, why you were asked to do this, because as a landscape architect, it wouldn't necessarily follow that you could design a garden that is both beautiful and edible.
Well, the beautiful part, yes, that's part of what landscape architects do as designers. We hope and aspire to create beautiful design work, and in landscapes in particular, but the edible part was what was new for me. And it's surprisingly easy to design a beautiful garden. In the end, it ended up being easy with edible plants, because they are so unique and beautiful in their own right. So many different textures and colors, different structures of the plants. And that's what her name is Terry Allen at Seeds of Change helped me with quite a bit, is understanding the different structure and textures of what those vegetables were going to look like, since I hadn't worked with them before.
We're talking about the Good Life Garden. It's an edible and beautiful demonstration garden on the UC Davis campus. Christina Reyes designed it. She's a landscape architect at UC Davis. How did you get started? What was the first thing you had to figure out or learn or design?
The first thing I had to, well, I started doing quite a bit of research about different edible plants, but also companion planting, because we knew it needed to be an organic garden. We were heading in that direction, and so
what does companion planting mean, and what does that have to do with organic gardening?
Well, companion planting is a method of selecting your plants so that you are attracting beneficial insects that will help you if you're having a pest problem, placing plants in proximity to each other that might help both with beneficial insects but also structurally. So one example would be bell peppers can get burned in the sun in the Sacramento area. And so one of the initial design ideas was to plant bell peppers in such a way that they would be shaded by the tomato plants, which go absolutely crazy in the Sacramento area. So that's another method of companion planting, is thinking about structure and growth.
So not only did the garden have to be beautiful and edible, but being organic, you also had certain other issues that had nothing to do with being edible or beautiful that you had to deal with, which was to make sure that the garden was designed to protect the plants from the heat, from pests and so on. Did
yes.
that mean you had to design with one arm behind your back?
A little bit, yeah. It was, a challenge also, one of the biggest challenges was designing a garden that would look good all year round. And so the second thing I had to think about, aside from learning quickly about edibles and what they look like and how they perform and grow, was creating a foundation, a structure of perennial herbs and plants that would stay all year round and provide an attractive, basically landscape design during the winter months and in between when crops are harvested and then replanted. It was trying to think about what would continue to provide an aesthetic show, basically, in those downtimes when the vegetables aren't performing necessarily or just getting started.
Also with us is the gardener at the UC Davis Good Life Garden, Arlene Kennedy. Arlene, welcome.
Hi.
Are there many different plants at this time of year that maybe you're not seeing at other times of the year?
Yeah, right now we have all the warm season crops growing.
The warm season crops, yeah. Give us examples.
Like bush beans and tomatoes and basil, bell peppers, chili peppers, corn. I could go on.
Yeah, well, you could go on. It sounds nice. Are these particularly decorative versions, let's say, of tomatoes? Because the goal of the garden is to look great as well as to be edible. I mean, are these particularly decorative-looking tomatoes?
With the tomatoes, tomatoes kind of pretty much always look like tomato plants. But we've incorporated a cool design element, which is that we stake our tomatoes with bright blue poles. Mm-hmm. So, and also, just the way tomatoes grow, they grow really high vertically, and so that gives a really cool look to the garden as well.
And do you have different colors of tomatoes, you know, these freaky colors with the heirloom tomatoes, or are they all red?
Yeah, we do have some really cool colors. We have, from Seeds of Change, a green zebra heirloom tomato, which is, when it's ripe, it's green with stripes on it.
I like that one.
It tastes really, that's my favorite too.
Yes.
And also Wild Boar Farms donated some tomatoes to us, and he has a pink Berkeley tie-dye, which is crazy.
pink Berkeley tie-dye. That's hilarious.
Yeah. So there's a lot of fun ones that way.
Is there a particular challenge about being a gardener in a garden that's meant to be both edible and decorative? Are the things that you have to do or you can't do that you might otherwise do because you're under pressure to make sure it looks as nice as possible?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Like, you know, it has to look good all the time. So whereas sometimes you might harvest a plant right at peak season, maybe we'll leave it in a little longer just because it looks good. For instance, leeks. You normally just harvest them before they're going to bloom, but we really like the way the flowers look.
They're beautiful.
Gorgeous. They're like these modern art-looking kind of flowers. They're long with big globes, kind of like this microphone right here. So we like to keep them in longer. They're really cool looking.
Yeah. Once you've harvested the crops, what happens to them?
Then we found with the Yolo County Food Bank, there's a recent graduate from UCD, Ryan, I don't remember his last name, but he heads a program there, the Food Bank Van, where you can just call him, anybody can call him, and he'll come with this refrigerated van and pick up whatever you have. It could be canned goods, and in our case, we have vegetables that we've harvested. So at the end of every season, when we have a huge load of produce, we call him, and he picks it up.
Christina, how big is the garden?
The garden is, well, the entire courtyard is about an acre, close to an acre. The actual planted vegetable beds and flower beds are close to 8,000 square feet, so approaching a quarter of an acre.
So much larger than the average garden, but not
yes.
size of a farm or anything like
True,
that.
True, yes. So, it's a productive garden, but would definitely not be enough food to, feed the masses long term. It's a modest production garden.
Usually when an architect designs something, they design it and then it's built and that's it. But given that this is something that ebbs and flows throughout the year, every year, is your job continuing?
Yes, it is. I do a new planting plan for the garden for every season. And the garden has about three seasons with a little bit of maybe minor design work and some work with Arlene, just based on how things look throughout the year. So I have three major planting design periods during the year, spring, summer, and fall. And it's a challenge, but it's getting easier. As the first year was more of a challenge. And as I ease into the process, I get more familiar with the plants that work in our particular growing conditions in Davis. We have some unique water issues and water quality issues. And so I learn a little bit more each time about what vegetables do the best and what plants look best at what time of year. And
did any plants surprise you where you thought, wow, this has turned out really well, we better make sure we do more of it?
Oh, yes, Arlene and I were just talking about this before we came on the show. Rudbeckia, autumn colors, also known as black-eyed Susan, was chosen actually at the last minute because we didn't get something else I wanted from a nursery.
Funny how that happens.
They didn't have enough, yeah. And it's a showstopper. The flowers are just amazing. It blooms in our garden, it seems, almost all year round.
Exactly.
That's a wonderful show. And then, of course, vegetable-wise, things with bright colors, bull's blood beets, red cabbages, all of those things have wonderful form and color.
So Arlene, the black-eyed Susan, that's a common name for it? Is that what it is?
Yeah, that's a common name for it.
What does it look like?
It looks like kind of like a sunflower type of flower. It's maybe 2.5 feet tall.
So a short sunflower.
Yeah, a short sunflower. It has black in the center and then these rust-colored yellow, oranges, petals, and it's just gorgeous all year long. It's blooming.
What's going to happen to the garden in, let's say, December?
Hmm.
Will there be much to see?
Well, yeah.
That's when we have our cool season crops. Like, we'll have all our neat rows of lettuces growing, and we'll have some sweet peas climbing up on the trellises.
Carrots and radishes.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, so this is a year-round job for you, Arlene.
Yeah.
Well, very nice. And Christina, can people go see this?
Oh, yeah. It's a public garden open to the public 24 hours a day, 7 days
Freak.
A week.
Oh, so if you just walk on campus, you can easily see it. You don't have to.
Yeah. Just in the courtyard of the Robert Mondavi Institute, the bright orange buildings, Mediterranean colored buildings. On campus, you can see them from the freeway.
Great. Well, it sounds very nice. And we have a couple of pictures on our website, capradio.org/insight. Photographs taken by Insight's very own Lynn Weaver. It looks great, it sounds great, and it sounds very tasty too. Christina Reyes is the landscape architect at UC Davis who designed the garden. Arlene Kennedy is the gardener. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a new website with everything you could ever want to know about baseball in Sacramento. To Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Email us suggestions to insight@capradio.org. Today on Talk of the Nation, once you internalize something, it's hard to let it go, even after you learn you've been totally wrong. A factual look at what we know and what we believe, and more on Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. Sacramento has a long baseball tradition, and you can explore pretty much every aspect of that history at a new website called baseballsacramento.com. The website's founder and editor joins us. He's Rick Cabral. Rick, welcome.
Hey, good to be here.
Wow, there's so much baseball information, statistics, history all over the place. What was missing from your point of view?
Just the rich history that Sacramento enjoys. It's always been a great baseball town, and I grew up here, and I played here, and always heard the great stories and heard about the people who played and still resided here. And so I just thought, you know, somebody's got to document those stories. And coupled with the history side of things, I wanted to make sure to provide, like, the youngsters with a resource for equipment and training and those kinds of things that I think that are very functional. And so there's an all-purpose resource there for people if they're interested.
Are you focusing on the pro game, the history of the game, local college and high school, or whatever?
All of the above.
All of the above.
Yeah. We have, you know, a number of people that still reside here. For instance, just the other day I got a chance to meet a guy who played in the pros in the 50s, Wally Westlake. And I'd heard of him all my life, you know, as a kid growing up. And a good friend, Alan O'Connor, brought me over to meet him. And, you know, he just told some wonderful stories. He played alongside of some of the great pros. And he still resides here in Sacramento. And, in fact, he came from the same high school that I went to, which is Christian Brothers.
And Alan O'Connor, who you just referred to, he's been on our show before.
Yeah.
He's the author of the book Gold and the Diamond, Sacramento's Great Baseball Players. Do you have a section on Sacramento's Great Baseball Players?
No, I don't really have a section per se like Alan has dedicated it to. But between myself and Mark McDermott, we're going through and trying to interview some of the guys that we really want to put down. Like, for instance, today I plan on talking to Bob Forsch, who had a long career in the majors and played for the St. Louis Cardinals. And so we're getting to people that we can finally, you know, profile and have a good representation on the site.
This must take a lot of your time.
It takes a good number of hours, yes.
And do you have a day job?
Right now, I'm freelancing in marketing and communications.
I see. My guest is Rick Cabral, founder and editor of BaseballSacramento.com. One of the stories that intrigues me that's on your site is about the longest professional home run hit in Sacramento. Tell us about that.
Well, that's a wonderful story. In fact, Alan O'Connor brought that story to my attention. A fellow by the name of Neil Sheridan played for the Solons in 1953. And on a hot July night, in fact, it was almost the exact time we're looking at right now. It was July 8th, 9th, that kind of time period. He hit a home run that they say went over 600 feet. The way they found out about it was very interesting. That night, they're celebrating in the clubhouse, and a young guy brought in a ball and said to Mr. Sheridan, "This ball went through the window of my car, which was parked on Burnett Way." And so the Solons officials went, "That's a long way." So the next day, they actually got out a tape measure, and they went and measured it at 620 feet. And just to be sure, you know, if they were going to put it like in the Guinness Book of Records, because up to that time, only Babe Ruth was thought to have hit a ball that far. So they actually had a surveying company in town measure it. 613 feet exactly is what they came up with. Muir and Train was the survey company. And so they got the word spread around in the sporting news, et cetera, that this was the longest professional home run ever measured.
That's a great story. Yeah. And you mentioned Babe Ruth, and he shows up on your website, too. He didn't. You know, he didn't play for the Solons, but he did come to town.
He did, in fact, on more than one occasion. But in 1927, he and Lou Gehrig, Yankee teammates, were on a barnstorming tour that was called the Bustin' Babes and Larrapin Lou's. And they each even had their own uniforms that, you know, read Bustin' Babes, Larrapin Lou's on it. And they had a 20-game schedule that went throughout America. California was a big stop along the way, and Sacramento had one of the games. And in the game, both guys hit a home run. And, you know, it just gave people west of the Mississippi an opportunity to see these two wonderful players.
So these were exhibition games.
Exactly.
And you also have a story about the only pitcher to have struck out the maximum number of batters in a pro game. What was that about?
Mark McDermott contributed that story. He had a chance to talk with both the key players in that incident. Harry Dunlop from Sacramento, went to Sac High, was the catcher in the game, and Ron Netschai is the pitcher who recorded 27 outs by way of strikeout. And he's the only player ever to strike out 27 guys in a professional game.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Rick Cabral, editor of BaseballSacramento.com. You have a lot of high school material as well, all-city baseball listings that you can't find anywhere else, really?
That's correct. Oh, yeah. Well, again, I attribute this to Mark McDermott. Mark was a former Sacramento Bee staffer, and in his spare time, he would go and collect all the statistics. He's a big fan of the high school and college games, especially. And so when I called him up, I said, "I'm interested in working with you. Do you happen to have these statistics?" He said, "Yeah, I have them right here." So he was more than gracious to allow me to upload them to the site. So we have a listing of all the all-city teams dating back to 1950 with a couple of years that we don't have it, but we're still trying to find those records. And then in addition, as we're talking to old players who open up their scrapbooks, like Ronnie King, for instance, a famous scout from Sacramento, loaned me his scrapbook, and he made All-City in 1946. So we're going to go back as far as we can when we get a chance to research those.
Who do you think is the greatest baseball person, not just player necessarily, greatest baseball person to come out of the Sacramento area?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that on my way over. You can break it down a couple different ways. I think the best hitter to play in the major leagues probably has to go to Derek Lee. It's either him or Stan Hack, who played in the 30s for the Chicago Cubs. Derek Lee is still playing. He's had a wonderful career, good slugger, you know, and I think an up-and-comer that's going to challenge him is Dustin Pedroia, who has, you know, a Most Valuable Player Award and also a World Series to his credit. Joe Marty is a guy who, if you remember Marty's Bar there on Broadway?
Yes.
Yeah. Joe Marty was probably one of the greatest players ever to come out of Sacramento, although his career was shortened by the war.
Is that a coincidence that Marty's Bar is near where the Solons Field was?
No, I don't think there's any coincidence at all. he knew that people were going to file out of Edmonds Field and come down there and come to his bar for refreshments.
You brought in a memento for me. It's a used baseball from Sac State. Tell us about it.
Oh, I like to go over to Sac State and watch the games. And by the way, for anybody that doesn't know it, there's a wonderful baseball program. You get to see some of the great college players come through there. They play in the Western Athletic Conference. And every once in a while, I'm lucky enough to find a foul ball that they didn't find. And that's what you got there.
Very nice. Someone very well known in baseball, but nothing, as far as I'm aware, to do with Sacramento, just died, George Steinbrenner of New York Yankees fame. Any thoughts or stories about George Steinbrenner?
Yeah, I think that his reputation will go down as you know, one of the great owners in the end. I mean, you know, they won a number of pennants and World Series under him. I think it was 7 World Series during his tenure. He was, if nothing, a winner. He wanted to make sure that team won at all costs. In many cases, I think the fans were a little upset with him in the beginning. But, yeah, George Steinbrenner will go down as a hero of New York Yankees.
And today, of course, is the day of the baseball All-Star Game. What do you think about the All-Star Game? There have been some changes to it over the years.
I think the All-Star Game is just as high in popularity as it's ever been. And, you know, I mean, we've got a wonderful group of young men that are coming up there and playing the game now, and they're still playing the game the right way, and yet at the same time they're hitting all the home runs, and now the pitchers are coming around and throwing the no-hitters, and there's baseball is probably as high in popularity now as it's ever been.
Finally, Rick, anything else in your mind about baseballsacramento.com that might be unusual about it that people might
I'd like to say is that we're always looking to fill those holes where we don't have the information. In fact, recently I put up a story about the 1962 Bishop Armstrong Falcons. They had a great team. They were known as the state team of the year. And as a result of that, somebody came to me and said, would you mind helping Christian Brothers in documenting the history of baseball? So I'm out looking for any information people have if they'd like to open up their old scrapbooks and help us fill in those history, because we're really here to preserve the past.
Are there a lot of gaps that you haven't been able to fill yet?
Pretty wide history, yeah. So there's a lot of things we're still looking for, yes.
No doubt.
And the website, or I should say the email address, is on the website, so they can contact me that way.
Rick Cabral, founder and editor of BaseballSacramento.com, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, bluegrass and Appalachian singer Susie Glaze. Thanks. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight is on Facebook at Insight on Capital Public Radio. Tomorrow, why a famous Foothills bar might close soon. It's Nevada City's chief Crazy Horse Saloon. The bar might shut at the end of this month because of a dispute between business owners. Americana singer Susie Glaze is touring Northern California. A native of Tennessee, she was raised with country and bluegrass music. Susie Glaze has acted on Broadway, but her singing career has focused on bluegrass and Appalachian music. Her latest record is called Green Kentucky Blues. She and two members of the High Lonesome Band are in our studio. Susie Glaze, Rob Carlson, Steve Rankin, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, Jeff. It's great to be with you.
Susie, when I just mentioned one of our topics on tomorrow's show, you and Steve and Rob looked at each other with shock.
Yes, because actually we had just arranged to go play the Crazy Horse tonight.
So
that should be okay.
It's the end tonight.
Of the month. The end of the month it closes.
So it looks like we're just getting in under the wire.
Yeah, well, who knows what's going to happen? I think it's a rather complicated story, which we'll get into tomorrow in Insight. Susie, you're from Tennessee, so you were raised with this music.
I was, actually. Though my parents were not Southerners, they were Midwesterners, and so they didn't feed me, so to speak, that music, but it was all around me. We were just down the road from Nashville, about 32 miles, so it was all around me, but I really didn't discover bluegrass, per se, until I moved to New York City, you know, because we were listening to theater music, and I was studying theater music. So when I got to New York City, I started listening more to bluegrass and discovered all the old greats then. So it's kind of ironic.
Well, what did you think about that kind of music when you were young, when it wasn't really part of your life? It was just sort of in the background.
Yeah, well, you know, I was confused because as a child, because it was the most prominent vendors of that music, so to speak, were the more mainstream country artists like Dolly Parton and Porter Wagoner and George Jones and all of the greats from the 50s and 60s. And so I didn't understand that bluegrass was really set apart from mainstream country music artists. It had a much different instrumentation and a much different history. It was sort of like pre-mainstream country music.
My guest is Susie Glaze. She's a singer of bluegrass and Appalachian music. Tomorrow night, she and the High Lonesome Band are at Evangeline's in Colfax. They're also in Berkeley on Thursday night. Rob Carlson and Steve Rankin from the band are also with us. Rob Carlson, welcome.
Hi, Jeff.
What do you do in the band?
Well, I'm the guitar player, principal guitar player, and the songwriter.
Yeah, I wrote most of the material.
You wrote the song that we're going to hear in a minute or so.
What song is it? It's called Blue Eyed Darling.
Good. Well, we'll look forward to hearing that, but let's hear from Steve Rankin, too. Steve, what do you do?
I am the mandolin player, and I have the great fortune of being married to Susie Glaze.
I see.
So I get to listen to her sing a lot, and it's a great pleasure, and it's a great being in the band with all these people and working and developing these songs. And I work a lot on the arrangements. Actually, the three of us are sort of the core of the band that work up the arrangements of the tunes and bounce the ideas around on how to actually perform these things.
Rob, anything you'd like to tell us about Blue Eyed Darling? What's the story behind the song?
Well, it's an interesting, thanks for asking. It's a murder ballad, which is a sort of a genre, a folk music genre, as you probably know. And the murder ballad idea was, it's a little bit interesting because usually it's the guy that kills the girl. We have a joke in the band, it's a hillbilly divorce, you know?
Oh, my goodness.
And but this time it's the other way around. The girl kills the guy, so it's a sort of an updated sort of girl power kind of a song, you know, which fits really well with for Susie.
Yeah.
And I had that title for that song for a long time, probably a couple years before I wrote it, because I liked the title. And I knew I wanted to write that song, and so I wrote it as a murder ballad lullaby. It's a woman singing to her daughter and telling a story that happened before. So it has kind of a complex backstory.
Well, let's hear it then. Blue Eyed Darling in our studio. It's Susie Glaze and the High Lonesome Band.
She lured him way out to the woods.
beautiful Blue-Eyed Darling, played in our studio by Susie Glaze and two core members of the High Lonesome Band, Rob Carlson and Steve Rankin. Rob wrote the song. Susie, you do a lot of songs by Gene Ritchie.
Yes.
Very well-known musical figure in the Appalachian region. And we're going to hear an a cappella song by Gene in just a minute. But tell people about Gene Ritchie, who she is, why she's important.
Oh, I'd be glad to. Especially in California, I think that the knowledge about Gene is somewhat spotty, and I'm happy to bring the music to people here in the state. Gene is an American folk music icon. She was born and raised in eastern Kentucky, and in a big family of what we know as we're calling song catchers. They were collectors of music and developers of music in their region. And when Jean graduated college, she studied social work. So she went to New York City to work at the Henry Street Settlement to learn about social work because she wanted to start programs in eastern Kentucky for the children. And she was performing with her dulcimer, which was an Appalachian instrument, and no one had ever seen it in New York City. And so they were intrigued with her music, and she would perform for the children there. And so she got to be well-known in New York for a really unique style and sound. And she got swept up then in the folk revival movement in the late 50s and early 60s. And so she suddenly found herself in the company of people like Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, and Alan Lomax discovered her and recorded almost everything she knew, over 300 songs for the Smithsonian. And so she became, you know, one of the real rocks of that revival movement. Now she's in her 80s and she's still living in New York, but discovering her whole body of work has been a revelation for me.
And the song that you and Rob and Steve are going to sing a cappella is?
It's just me.
Oh,
it's just a solo a cappella. Jean always wrote music because of a story she knew that did not have a song accompanying it. In the Eastern Kentucky culture, in their life and in their world, in their family, a song always accompanied a story. If there was a story that happened in the world, there was always a song that was written about it. And so when, to her mind, there was a story that had no song, she knew she had to write one. So West Virginia Mine Disaster is the story of a mine disaster in West Virginia, obviously, but written from a woman's standpoint, which she had seen that there was nothing written like that from a woman's standpoint on a mine disaster event.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing it. This is Susie Glaze singing West Virginia Mine Disaster.
Say, did you see him going? It was early this morning. He passed all your houses on the way to the coal. He was tall, he was slender, and his dark eyes so tender. His occupation was mining. West Virginia, his home. It was just after 12, I was feeding the children. Ben Mosley came running to give us the news. Number 8 is all flooded, many men are in danger. And we don't know their number, but we fear they're all doomed. So I picked up the baby and I left all the others to comfort each other and pray for our own. There's Timmy, 14, and there's John, not much younger. Their own time soon will be coming to go down the black hole. Oh, if I had the money to do more than just feed them, I'd give them good learning, the best could be found. Then when they grew up, they'd be checkers and weighers, and not spend their time drilling in the dark underground. Oh, what can I say to his poor little children? And what can I tell his old mother at home? And what can I say to my heart that's clear broken? To my heart that's clear broken, if my darling is gone. Say, did you see him going? It was early this morning. He passed all your houses on the way to the call. He was tall, he was slender, and his dark eyes so tender. His occupation was mining, West Virginia his home.
Well, that is very beautiful. The Gene Ritchie song, West Virginia Mine Disaster, sung in our studio by Susie Glaze. Susie Glaze and the High Lonesome Band are in Northern California. They're playing sort of informally tonight at the Chief Crazy Horse Saloon in Nevada City. Tomorrow night, they're at Evangeline's in Colfax, and Thursday, they're at the Freight and Salvage in Berkeley. Susie Glaze and band members Rob Carlson, Steve Rankin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Jeff. It's great, Jeff, to be with you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the final part of our series on the four very different plans to remodel derelict blocks of downtown Sacramento's K Street. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can stream Insight at capradio.org/insight. The fate of two derelict blocks in downtown Sacramento will be decided tonight by the City Council. Four plans are being considered for rebuilding the 700 and 800 blocks of K Street. We're looking at all those plans in Insight. We wrap up our coverage this morning. Joining me is Brad Wiblin, Vice President of Bridge Housing, part of the team behind one of the four proposals to develop that part of Sacramento's K Street. Brad, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
What are you and your team planning to build on 700 and 800 blocks of K Street?
Our proposal included a two-phase project on each block, about 160 apartments above street front retail on each block. So a total of 320 units and about 30,000 feet of retail. We also had incorporated the 48,000 square foot Crest building, which is directly adjacent to the city-owned properties. Part of that process included the 22-unit Bellevue Hotel, which is has some historic resources there, and we were going to incorporate that into a mixed-income apartment building. We would also maintain and improve the retail storefronts on the 700 block in order to sort of weave these older buildings that have some great character in with new housing, new retail for what we hope would be a green, eclectic mix of uses that was, frankly, financeable in today's environment.
How much of those two blocks would still be the original buildings if your proposal was chosen?
Well, on the 700 block, we would retain the storefront only of the retail. Behind that, we would reconfigure those buildings to accommodate more modern retail users. On the 800 block, we would maintain really only the Bellevue Hotel. So maybe that's 30% of that side of the street.
How do you know there's a market for all this housing on that part of K Street?
Well, one of Bridge's strategies in this whole effort from the very beginning, having looked at K Street and talked to a number of folks, including our local partners, was we felt the big idea was that housing kind of needed to lead the change down there. If you want to change the tenor and character of the street in front of these blocks, from what I could tell, a mix of homeless folks, teenagers getting off the trolley to go shop at the mall, we needed families and urban pioneers to also populate that street. In our scenario, we have a mixed income rental project. About 60% of that would be market rate apartments, much like the J Street lofts that have proven a market down there. And then the balance would be affordable rental units for families earning, $25,000 to $45,000 a year.
My guest is Brad Wiblin of Bridge Housing, part of the team behind one of the four proposals to redevelop the 700 and 800 blocks of downtown Sacramento's K Street. The City Council will choose among the four proposals tonight. Based on what I've read and heard, at least some members of the City Council and the mayor want something really splashy, a destination for downtown Sacramento. Is there anything that corresponds to that in your proposal?
Well, I'm afraid maybe we lost the vision competition. We were really leading with a project that we felt could be financed and built today. I understand, like you, from reading that a number of folks have come out in support of another proposal, which is a bigger, splashier idea. I think if that is able to come off, it really would be fantastic. We've been at this a long time ourselves, and so this site looked an awful lot like some places in Oakland and San Francisco and San Diego that we've worked, and frankly wanted to build something that was closer to what we thought was achievable.
You said that your project is financeable in the current market. What does it cost, and where would the money come from?
Total cost of the two phases that I've described is about $105 million. There's a combination of conventional mortgage debt, $35 million or so, about $28 or $29 million in equity. This is a combination of bridge equity and equity that we generate through the sale of the low-income housing tax credit. And we did have a pretty sizable commitment from the city that we were requesting. It was about $11 to $12 million per phase, so a total of about $23.5 million of redevelopment agency, mostly housing set-aside funds, money that needed to go toward housing or would need to go toward housing in any case.
How do you react to the apparent show of support for some of the other projects from city council members and key interests downtown?
Well, you know, we're a company that knows what we know, and we know how to do a few things well. And quite frankly, I'm not used to finishing, you know, third or fourth in a competition like this. So I'm not thrilled. But you know, you've got some very talented local folks there in Sacramento, and you know, we're doing our best to try to contribute in that market where we can.
Okay. Well, Brad Wiblin, Vice President of Bridge Housing, part of the team behind one of the four proposals to redevelop the 700 and 800 blocks of downtown Sacramento's K Street. There will apparently be a decision tonight. Brad Wiblin, thank you so much for joining us.
Jeffrey, thanks for your time.
Well, there's one more proposal that we've yet to discuss, and there's a well-known name associated with that proposal. I asked Capital Public Radio news reporter Ben Adler who that person is and what the proposal is all about.
David Taylor, a very well-known Sacramento developer, and he's teaming up with a couple of other groups as well, including Zidon Properties, which is Joe Zidon Z Gallery, the retail chain. And originally, Mr. Zidon was hoping to put a Z Gallery on the 700 block of K Street, and he owns some of that land, and then he got tired of waiting for that land to be ready to develop, and he ended up selling it back to the city. And now he's teaming up with David Taylor and a couple other groups, CIM Group and Domus Development, and they're looking at also a mix of residential and retail. So some low to moderate income residential units, good 12,000 square feet of retail parking. All that's on the north side of the 800 block of L Street. And then on the K Street part of the 800 block, a new four-level building on the south side that would have 66 market rate housing units, about 10,500 square feet of retail parking, and a rooftop courtyard garden. That's on the 800 block. Then at the 700 block, they're proposing to retain the structures in their entirety, renovate them, and then add about 50,000 feet of retail and more than that amount of office space. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty ambitious project on those two blocks.
Well, whichever one of these four proposals gets chosen will presumably have a big impact on this high-profile but rather derelict part of downtown Sacramento. My guest is Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio news reporter. Ben, the City Council is scheduled to discuss these proposals tonight and vote on them?
Yes. And what should make tonight's meeting interesting is that there are conflicting recommendations from City Hall, and it has all the makings of a big showdown tonight. So it should be an interesting meeting. The dual recommendations, one comes from a city council committee. It's got three council members and Mayor Kevin Johnson, and they are endorsing the Authenticity, the Boca Ria project that was on your show, Jeffrey, yesterday, Monday morning. And they're basically saying, we want to think big. This is, certainly of the four proposals, it's got its sights set pretty high on coming up with a real landmark for the Sacramento area on these two blocks. And the council members and the mayor, you hear the mayor all the time say, we need to strive to be everything we can and think big. And I think the council members really like, I'm slightly putting words in their mouth, but I would imagine that they really like the thinking big aspect of that proposal.
And for people who didn't hear the show yesterday, this authenticity project would include this Boqueria, which is a sort of a permanent farmer's market, but a lot more agricultural, food-related things, a permanent home for the California Hall of Fame, and also a large live music venue.
Exactly. And then the other recommendation comes from a selection committee with city staff and outside experts. And they actually prefer two different developers, mixed-use projects, some housing, some retail, for the 700 block DNS development and for the 800 block David Taylor. Now, they reached the same conclusion as the Downtown Sacramento Partnerships Board, and Executive Director Michael Alt with the partnership says the authenticity, the Boqueria project, just has too many unanswered questions.
We just didn't really know how some of the future phases yet at this point were going to be funded and where the city was going to be at. And so, on the information we had at that point, we thought the, DNS and David Taylor gave us the best chance more quickly to move forward at this time.
So there seem to be some important and differing camps here lining up behind different projects.
Except for the point that you only need 5 votes for a council majority, and if the 3 council members and the mayor who were on that city council ad hoc committee stick with the recommendation they made, they only need 1 more vote. So if you have to handicap this, you kind of feel like the authenticity goes in with a leg up. But the fact that some city staffers and the Downtown Sacramento Partnership, which is a pretty influential group that has the ear of a lot of people at City Hall, that they're all saying, we're a little nervous about the authenticity. We aren't quite sure about some of their financing, that their project won't finish as soon as some of the others. That could be some cause for concern at the council. We'll just have to wait and see.
Is there any rush with this? Is there some timeline that the city is working on?
It's arbitrary, but they are certainly feeling a sense of urgency. And if you want to know why, just look at K Street right now on the 700 and 800 blocks. They're not particularly fun blocks to visit, and I think the city is doing everything it can to change that. Cars are going to be allowed back on K Street sometime in the relatively near future. That has gotten city council approval. They've already let bikes back onto K Street. Certainly the mayor and the city are looking around to see if there might be buyers for the downtown plaza, the Westfield Mall, and we'll have to see what happens there. So a lot of moving parts on K Street. I don't think the city wants to waste any more time than absolutely necessary to get some construction going at the 700 and 800 blocks of K Street.
Yeah, they want something going. They want it done soon. They don't want it to cost too much. Make it a destination.
Hey, piece of cake, right?
Ben Adler, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And there are links in our webpage, capradio.org/insight, to our other segments on this issue, redeveloping the 700 and 800 blocks of K Street, also a report by Ben Adler. And in case you're wondering why we talked with principals involved with 3 of the 4 proposals but relied on that summary from Ben of the 4th, you should know that we invited developer David Taylor several times, but to no avail. That's Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver and Natalie Rothfels. Today's engineer was Mohammed Mirpour. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Thank you. At Insight, we have one goal.
It's appropriate that I provide an insight.
I like your accent, by the way.
To get the answers you want to hear.
Well, that's true.
You're the first person to ask me that. Seriously.
You know, that's a good question.
From interesting people of every stripe.
You have done your homework, Jeffrey.
What do you think is going to come out of all this?
Nothing good.
It really isn't funny, but...
You know all my little secrets.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.